In the beginning, I just want to lay a little bit of groundwork for the themes I'd like to spend more time with. So if you look at the early texts and teachings of the Buddha, you see this grouping of qualities that are highly esteemed, of kindness, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity. These qualities are touched upon. It's like they're threads that run through all of the teachings. They are called the Brahma Viharas, or the sublime abidings of boundless kindness, boundless compassion, joy, and equanimity. They essentially describe the deepest potential we have as human beings for psychological and emotional freedom. I have spent, over the last couple of years, I've been looking at these and the ways in which they are potentially insight practices, depending on how they are approached. Now, when the Buddha talks about the fruition of these qualities, he actually speaks about them as immeasurable. They have no conditions. They are free from delusion and confusion. They embrace all living beings and all experience. Now, Brahma, of course, if you think about the times in which the Buddha was teaching, Brahma, of course, described the ultimate of spiritual development, often translated as divine. Now, Vihara comes from the word in Pali, which means monastery, the places where we dwell, the places where we make our home, and that with the cultivation of these qualities, they become the very fabric of the mind and heart, not places we periodically visit and then forget about. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says, when standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, let us establish well this mindfulness, the mindfulness of Metta. This is said is the divine abiding. There is another discourse, actually, where the Buddha says there is no higher mindfulness than Metta. So the first thing I would like you to just, and I know some of you have had a lot of experience around the Brahma Viharas, but the first thing I'd like you to do is to at least allow for the possibility that mindfulness and metta are not used as separate concepts or teachings or cultivations in Buddhist meditation, that they are seen to be interwoven, and at times the words are used interchangeably. Now, in the development of the Buddha's teachings over centuries, I think something very curious happened to the Brahma Viharas, because they're often seen as being the poor cousins of insight practice, a kind of a side dish to the main menu. Yet in looking more closely at the early texts, there is an emerging very, very different view in which the Brahma Viharas are seen to be taught by the Buddha as complete paths of awakening in themselves. So just want you to make room for that possibility. Not as some secondary practice, not as some kind of nice emotional development or relational development, but as complete paths of liberation in themselves. And I can, for anyone who's more interested in this sort of references of these. I could give you some references. The Buddha describes this liberation through the Brahmaviharas as two words in Pali, which are called Cheta Vimutti, the measureless liberation of the mind through the Brahmaviharas of friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So I just want to go through actually a short list of the role that these qualities play in the kind of overall teaching. First of all, there is the ethical role. The Brahmaviharas, alive and cultivated, applied, embodied, moment to moment, are said to be the guiding principles of all ethical action. When the Buddha described integrity, he does not speak about integrity simply about following a set of precepts or a set of rules or guidelines. He actually speaks about looking at the shape of the mind that is informing our words, thoughts, and actions. And when he speaks about ethics, he speaks about it as a conscious cultivation of thoughts, words, and acts of metta, of boundless friendliness, free of aversion, free of ill will. Something I think it's very important to register that. The second function of the training in these qualities is that they are training in intention. They're training in intention. The Brahmaviharas are not particularly states of experience. They are inclinations of the heart, the inclinations of the mind. So learning and cultivating these qualities that I've spoken about, we are learning to incline the mind, incline the heart, towards our capacity to meet our world with kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. When the Buddha saw, as we see in our own experience, the very pervasive nature of greed, hatred, and delusion that can torment us individually and universally, these very deeply rooted patterns that create and recreate dukkha and suffering moment to moment in our lives. He suggested that the way out of these habit patterns, which are inclinations of the mind, by the way. Notice that our habit patterns are inclinations of the mind. And he said the way out of these habit patterns and the way to the end of suffering would be to cultivate the intentions of kindness, joy, compassion, and renunciation. And to live in this intentional way is the way of beginning to uproot the tendencies that torment the heart and that create division in the world. Now, an intentional life then requires mindfulness, requires a moment-to-moment willingness to look at distress and its causes in our world, but in our very personal world, in our very personal world. So the Brahmaviharas, in this sense, are explicitly spoken about as antidotes to greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the job of the Brahmaviharas, to uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. So looking at the Brahmaviharas as insight practices, we can see that they actually start, like the whole of this teaching starts, with an understanding of the Four Ennobling Truths, an investigation of that. That yes, there is distress, it is to be understood, and its causes to be understood. And when the Buddha speaks about dukkha and speaks about distress and torment, he gets actually pretty consistent and coherent in his teaching that if we actually really want to see the end of distress, we really need to be so honest in looking at the ways in which greed, hatred, and delusion operate. They're big words, but they have many, many manifestations. And the Brahma Viharas, as insight practices, are dedicated to uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. The third piece of the Brahma Viharas I would like to just touch upon is that they are not concerned solely with personal and inner development. I think this is important. I mean, many people come to practice because they have issues with their own mind and heart. And it is very easy, actually, in the practice to become really quite naturally and quite humanly and quite rightly concerned with personal inner development. There's a very close near enemy to that, of becoming actually personally contracted. We could go into that later. But of course, there's a way in which we take greed, hatred, and delusion so personally. You know, it's my fault. It says something about me as a person. You know, I'm a terrible person. I need to use the practice to improve myself, to get better, you know, to do all these things. And on one level, there's a kind of soundness in that thinking, because the practice is always about taking personal responsibility for our own hearts and minds. But the edge is that in that taking of personal responsibility, there is also a taking too personally the contents of our own experience and in greed, hatred, and delusion, and turning it into something else, a journey of kind of personal improvement. And I think when you look at the Buddha's teaching, of course, he is concerned with the personal and he is concerned with the universal. Everybody matters. You know, everybody's story in many ways is unique and to be honored and to be respected. But the themes of greed, hatred, and delusion, of course, are very universal themes. They are to be understood. And in this sense, the Brahma Viharas are concerned with the personal, but they're deeply concerned with keeping in mind the universal, because they are relational qualities, concerned with just, respectful, harmonious relationships, communities, and societies. They are not just concerned with what I individually experience. They're concerned with how we are in the world and what we are bringing and what kind of footprint we are leaving in the world, what we are contributing moment to moment to these relationships that we are always in. The relationships that we are always in. So metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity are essentially incompatible with hatred, rage, fear, and mistrust. They're said to be the cause of peacemaking, the ways to heal conflict and division, to bring unity in places of disconnection, the ways to bring cooperation and trust between people and within communities. Now, this is actually hard stuff, you know, because I don't know how it is for you in your life, but isn't it just easier to abandon difficult relationships and difficult people? And isn't it just easier to kind of take our attention away and think, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, I can get rid of this? Isn't it easier sometimes to close our eyes at times to our societies and the world that we live in, feeling perhaps that it's too much, and maybe it doesn't have so much to do with us, we might think. But actually what the Brahma Viharas are actually asking us to do is to really open our eyes and to be deeply concerned with the kind of communities, the kind of societies, the kind of relationships that we are all part of, and to be a conscious participant in them, aware of the footprint that we are making in the world and in our lives through our speech, our thoughts, and our actions. So the fourth piece that I would mention about the Brahma Viharas is that they are, of course, meditative pathways inextricably interwoven with mindfulness. Now, we all have moments of joy in our life. We have moments of kindness, of compassion and equanimity. And sometimes they almost surprise us. Sometimes they almost feel like a kind of accidental encounter, like, where'd that come from? You know, that moment of compassion, that moment of joy. Yet, as meditative developments, of course, the Brahma Viharas require and ask for exactly the same dedication as any other meditative pathway, if they're to be brought to fruition and to become unshakable. And this is the nature of these qualities. As insight fruitions, they are unshakable. Not moments of metta, not moments of compassion, not moments of joy, but unshakable abidings of the heart. That's a big prospect. So we learn through sustained practice to incline the heart towards kindness, towards compassion, towards joy and equanimity, until they become, with practice, the natural resting place of the heart. And where do we apply this training? Not in ideal conditions. Not when we're only with people we love and have affection for. Where do we apply this training? In every moment of ill will, in every moment of aversion, in every moment of contractedness, in every moment of imbalance. It's a pretty rigorous training that rests upon insight. As the Buddha put it, what the mind and considers and reflects upon in a sustained way, to this their mind will incline and bend. What the mind considers and reflects upon in a sustained way, to this their mind will bend and incline. I think that's worth really reflecting on, because it's actually looking, where are our thoughts mostly dwelling in a day? Where are the places our mind is most easily drawn to or in a more familiar way shaped by? Do we find ourselves in a way considering and reflecting upon, you know, thoughts of resentment or irritation or ill will or the various things we can obsess about? I mean, this is about very much becoming familiar with what our minds and hearts are doing in our days. Because what we consider and reflect upon in a sustained way, to this our mind will bend and incline. In many ways, habit patterns, this is what we call the kind of evolution of sankharas, the evolution of habit patterns. The evolution of the emotional and psychological habit patterns does not come from nowhere. It comes out of this sustained reflecting upon and considering in our lives. So the next piece I'd just like to mention about the Brahma Viharas is they are called immeasurable or boundless because their very nature is to be inclusive and unconditional. They are not limited by preferences or partiality. They embrace all beings and experience, and actually it doesn't matter how we feel about them. It doesn't matter how we feel about them. I remember in my own practice at one time going to a teacher and struggling with metta practice around, you know, one of my worst enemies. And I said, you know, I don't feel good about this. He says, what's that got to do with anything? not about how we feel about them. I know Westerners, I often get a lot of flack about this piece. We have evolved, I think, a way of thinking in the West where what we feel becomes the most authentic, is defined as authenticity. And that if we don't feel something, we shouldn't do it because it would be inauthentic. I just want to put it out, and I want to be defensive or aggressive about it, but this has nothing to do with the path of awakening. It doesn't matter whether we like something or someone or dislike them, whether they are close to us or not. Ajahn Sumedho once put it, he said, it's not difficult for me to feel kindness towards things that I like, such as kittens and puppies, cute children and pleasant people when they say nice things, you know, sunny weather, etc. I have no problem with all of this. But what should I do when people and things are foul and nasty? I'm sure we can all guess the Buddha's answer. Cultivate and apply the Brahma-viharas. I think it's very important to understand what a radical leap this is for consciousness not to be guided by what we feel like. They're not about what we feel, they are deeply concerned with actually what we do. This is actually one of the biggest concerns of the Brahma-viharas. They're concerned with what we do, with how we act, how we live, how we respond as we move through this world. Recognizing, as I mentioned last night, that indeed we are always practicing something, whether we're silent or speaking, still or moving, and the pathways of the immeasurables actually ask us to look at what we are doing. And if we're dedicated to awakening, we may very well be guided to act in ways that are different than what we feel in that moment. That's not a kind of inner betrayal. It's not a kind of inner denial of what we're feeling, because that too is embraced with metta and with mindfulness. But instead, it is bringing into a more coherent view what it is we're actually committed to and what kind of path we want to be walking in this life. So I want to just actually, and then I'm going to take a pause moment, look at the formula that runs through the pathways of cultivating the Brahma-viharas. Here a yogi, a disciple, dwells pervading one direction with a heart filled with metta, likewise the second, the third, and the fourth, pervading the entire world everywhere and equally with a heart filled with boundless friendliness, abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity and free from distress. Pervading all the directions with compassion, abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity and free from distress. Here, a disciple dwells pervading all directions filled with a heart filled with joy, pervading the entire world everywhere and equally with a heart of joy, abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity and distress. Pervading the entire world everywhere and equally, a heart filled with equanimity, abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity and free from distress. It's a basic formula. It's a big ask. Free from enmity, free from distress, grown great, abundant, without conditions. It sounds like a big ask, and yet the size of the task is only ever equal to the size of the moment. We don't practice yesterday's metta. We don't practice tomorrow's compassion. We don't rehearse next week's equanimity. We can only tend to the mind and the heart of this moment, and we recognize that we don't begin with boundless metta. We don't begin with boundless compassion or joy or equanimity, looking honestly at the pathways of our mind. We actually probably recognize that there are boundaries, there are limits to the metta and the compassion and the joy and equanimity we feel or can extend or can experience. Yet the great genius of the Buddha, in my understanding, is his ongoing capacity to build upon what we already have tasted. You know, when the Buddha speaks about the possibilities of the human heart, he doesn't speak about something that we have no idea what he's talking about. You know, metta, you know, friendliness, joy, compassion. We have all tasted those possibilities within our own experience and our own hearts and minds. And what the Buddha is actually encouraging is to build upon that which we have already glimpsed, but in a disciplined way. And in one discourse, the Buddha says, it is a disciplined mind that knows true joy. That it's a disciplined mind that knows true metta. And when he uses the word discipline in not this sense, he's not talking about, you know, this tight, contracted, you know, subservient kind of mind, but a well-trained heart, a well-trained mind. I believe, or I would like to propose, that if we look carefully at the Brahmaviharas, we see the ways in which they hold the entire path of awakening within them. There is ethics, integrity in its deepest sense, guided not by self-cherishing or self-protection, but by the cherishing of all living beings. The metaphor used in the Metta Sutta is the one of just as a loving parent would cherish and protect their only child, so too shall we cherish all living beings. So there's the ethics part. In terms of the path of awakening, many of you will be familiar with, there is sila, ethics, there is samadhi, focus, collectedness, and there is panya, or insight. And look at how these register within the Brahmaviharas. Clearly, there is an ethical dimension. There is also samadhi, training, developing the heart and mind that holds the domain of wise intention, sustained attention, mindfulness, single-pointedness, concentration, qualities shared with all pathways of meditative development. But there is also panya. There is penetrating insight. The Brahmaviharas, in my understanding, are not concerned with transient states or emotion, but with radically transforming the shape of our heart and mind. And this is what I will return to. Anyway, that might be a good pause moment. We're not going anywhere. We're just having a pause moment. Does anybody at this point, before I go on, have anything they want to raise or question or reflect on? Yeah.
You said that things that you do or should do won't always feel right, and that it takes discipline. I'm wondering if that's related to sort of an evolutionary and developmental tendencies that we have that aren't...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of evolutionary developmental tendencies, you know, we see the kind of very core patterns of the mind to avoid pain and to pursue safety and pleasure. I mean, the very core patterns, evolutionary patterns, they're pretty hardwired, you know, which served us well when the tigers were outside the door. You know, we actually don't have many saber-toothed tigers anymore, but the habit patterns remain and they are built upon. They've actually become far more sophisticated. And actually the form of protection now often, not always, but often that they are serving is protecting the sense of self. Now, it's not to say that we should ignore messages of pain or signals of danger. It's not in any way to imply that. this is, you know, very much a part of kind of skillful means and discriminating wisdom in our life. You know, we need to know not to jump off cliffs. We need to know that there are situations where it's not helpful to be in. And, this is part of the domain of discriminating wisdom. What I'm talking about, I think, is something a little bit different. It's something the way that we've kind of hijacked those kind of, you know, almost evolutionary principles and turned them into a kind of ideology. And it's an ideology that says, you know, if I don't feel good about something, I should avoid it. You know, or if I feel bad about something, you know, I should seek something I feel good about. And we can see the way that that kind of ideology in some, you know, often very pre-verbal way seems to actually pervade our consciousness, but in and our actions. This is also the bigger piece, you know, that it's part of living a kind of agitated life. And I think, strangely, it part of a kind of a kind of an ideology, in my understanding, of this sort of individualistic culture that we live in, you know, that's so almost worships individuality, that what I feel like becomes the guiding principle. You know, it doesn't necessarily have any ethical implications. You know, I want more of that. I don't care if there's less for somebody else. You know, it feels good. You know, so it doesn't necessarily have any ethical implications, but also it can become this kind of I don't know. I see it becoming almost a sacred place of you know, living by aversion and craving, rather than by actually what are we most deeply committed to inwardly. So very important to acknowledge. It's not ignoring signals of danger. It's not denying signals of delight that come from the world and from within, but it's looking at where there's been created a certain ideology that we call authenticity, that is actually kind of actually serving craving and aversion, that doesn't relieve suffering. It doesn't relieve suffering. Does that answer? Thank you. And I do think it's a theme really well worth spending some time with, because we're often even not even so conscious how much it's a kind of be a guiding principle in our life. You know, if you think about how many times in life, in many ways, we operate counter to what we feel like because something is more worthy. I mean, any of you have raised a child, you know, when a baby cries in the middle of the night, you don't feel like getting up. You get up because that's what's needed and because you're committed to something more deeply than what I feel like. I think about it on retreats. What would it be like if I said to people, I only want you to come sit if you really feel like it. You know, if you don't feel like it, please, you know, don't come. And I also notice that many times I'm convinced many people don't feel like coming to sit or going to walk. And I'm very aware that we don't go and drag people out of their bedrooms, you know, we don't do roll call. And I notice people turn up. Now, isn't that interesting? And I don't even think there's always a conscious recognition the way that I'm in that moment of turning up, rather than being governed by the kind of impulse or feeling at the moment, my actual actions are being guided by something that I feel more deeply valuable and committed to. And I also know that if, you know, say in that retreat example, if I had ever done in my own practice only what I felt like, I'm pretty sure my practice would never have deepened. I'm pretty sure it's that kind of more underlying commitment that kind of acknowledges, but that is not subservient to the feeling of the moment. That actually allows the deepening. And I think this is true in many of areas of our life, not just practice.
I was interested in I'm just kind of reflecting on the idea of cultivation as opposed to where you said self-improvement, and I was asking myself, you know, so what does cultivation look like? And it's not just self-improvement, the difference between like healthy cultivation. And I thought of where you talked about we can only cultivate in the moment. We can only be in the moment. And that might be a helpful guideline to me.
Yeah.
I thought that might be, because sometimes when I say should, and I'm already into like dogma, or, you know, I'm going down the path, but if I keep it to this moment, then I think that was helpful. I just thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important discernment to make. I mean, first of all, recognizing, of course, cultivation is always present moments. It's the only place it can be. You know, we can't cultivate, as I mentioned, tomorrow's experience. I think self-improvement is a far more complex package, isn't it? I mean, you know, it holds the whole territory of success and failure, good and bad, right and wrong, progress, regression, despondency, ambition. You know, self-improvement is a very, very complex package. And what is it, and I think also a real question in noticing that distinction is, what is it in the service of? Okay, so what is cultivation, say, of metta or joy or compassion? What is it in the service of? Or mindfulness, what is it in the service of? When we see ourselves moving towards more cultivating an idealized image of who we should be, what is that in the service of? I mean, they're also operating in different territories, aren't they? I mean, the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is not just about me, it's about how we are in life. I mean, self-improvement is not really interested in anybody else. I mean, that's actually a good question to ask. Okay, so I just want to, if I can, I'd like to finish this little bit of groundwork piece. I just want to enter the territory of looking at the Brahma Viharas perhaps a little bit differently than many of us have been exposed to them. The way that we have, as Western practitioners, mostly inherited the Brahma Viharas and their practices, is as concentration practices, as samadhi practices. In fact, you will find many teachers who will be quite explicit in saying these are concentration practices. Mm-hmm. They serve as concentration practices when they are undertaken in a way in which we constantly repeat a few phrases in a very sustained way, keep the phrases going. And it's a good practice, by the way. It's a very useful concentration practice. And through doing that, the mind becomes collected, it becomes focused, it becomes concentrated. This is how many people use the Brahma Viharas. Nothing wrong with it. Very skillful means. We also see in the way that we've inherited the Brahma Viharas, they go through the different domains of human relationship. We start with ourselves, we go to a benefactor, to a good friend, to a more indifferent person, to a difficult person, to all beings. And I don't even know where that came from. It certainly doesn't come from the Metta Sutta. If we were using the domains from the Metta Sutta, we would be doing the weak and the strong and the tall and the small, and, you know, we'd be completely different. But anyway, it's useful. It's a very systematic practice that many people have found incredibly useful in developing concentration, even developing absorption or jhana states. So it's a good, I have no argument with this. I think it's incredibly skillful means, and for sure the capacity to sustain mindfulness in this way is an essential component of any path. However, I do feel, my own feeling is that to approach the Brahmaviharas solely as a concentration practice does them a grave injustice. It is perhaps helpful to recognize that the approach to the Brahmaviharas that many of us have inherited and been taught essentially was introduced hundreds and hundreds of years after the Buddha's death. By Buddha Ghosa as the endeavor to codify the Buddha's teaching in the Visuddhimagga. And that somehow these qualities or these pathways ended up in the concentration section where they've lived ever since. I have no idea why they ended up there. I don't see any scriptural support for them to be presented as concentration practices. Now, there's a whole kind of, I think, reevaluation of this happening, which you may be entirely disinterested in. But there's a whole reevaluation of this happening, I think, in many people reading, going back to read the early discourses, also in their Sanskrit and their Chinese versions, looking at the Sutta Napata, which I think is very widely recognized as being the earliest and perhaps one of the most authentic and intact of the Buddha's teachings. But in looking at the early texts, not agreeing with this classification of the Brahmaviharas as concentration practices, but instead looking at the way the Buddha speaks about the Brahmaviharas as a compelling motivation for all meditative development and as complete paths of liberation in themselves. So just, I mean, you may be completely disinterested in this discussion, but I think I need to at least put it out there. I mean, so what I would like to do over this weekend is to actually look at the Brahmaviharas as insight practices. How do they work? What are they dedicated to? How are they practiced? And I think in my own experience of undertaking these practices, I've always found it the most helpful actually to take them on board as insight practices. In the Dhammapada, there's a verse that says, the practitioner who dwells in kindness with confidence in the Buddha's teaching attains the peaceful state, nibbana, the blissful cessation of conditioning. It is also, I think, very important to recognize that although I'd like to reflect on each of the Brahmaviharas independently, we could never conceive of them as being separate, but that friendliness, joy, compassion, equanimity, these are qualities that are dynamic and interactive process, engaging with one another. There's a wonderful short verse from the Tibetan tradition, Teacher Longchenpa, he put it, out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy, and sheltered beneath the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. Seeing them purely as interwoven, going to some of the early Sri Lankan teachers, one says, love gives to equanimity its boundless nature. Compassion guards equanimity from falling into indifference. Equanimity gives selflessness to metta, gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion. Equanimity guards joy from sentimentality. It brings all of the noble qualities of the heart together in freedom. That's good. To put it kind of slightly differently, immeasurable metta, it is guarding compassion from making hierarchies of suffering, including some and excluding others. It is acknowledging that all beings are worthy of compassion, that in fact all suffering asks for compassion, no matter how slight or how great. that metta is so important in bringing to equanimity its selfless and caring quality. That equanimity hasn't left metta behind. It hasn't left care behind. It is engaged rather than dissociated. And compassion is guarding love and joy from forgetfulness, always bearing in mind the depths of suffering that exist in the world. Compassion is guarding joy and friendliness from becoming states of attachment. And compassion is stirring love and joy to reach out, boundless in their embrace, boundless in their embrace. Joy is very important because the compassionate opening to the world of suffering is in danger of being overwhelmed. And joy eases the rawness of the heart, gladdens the heart, and enables us to meet suffering without fear. Equanimity, deeply rooted in insight, guards the mind from its urge to fix everything, to control, to assume an exaggerated responsibility. It brings an inner home of stability and poise. Equanimity brings courage to compassion, patience, and steadfastness.